Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what, I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3, here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You are listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
Before. It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X.
Morning. Welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast and listen later at your leisure. This is the late May bank holiday, Saturday the 23rd of May. That is if you're listening on catch up. Got Julian Pauly alive in the studio as usual. Later in this hour, we'll be talking to our PG, and our guest speaker for this week, and indeed every fourth Saturday of the month, is Chris Dale, and we'll be talking to him about salts. Lots of other things to talk about before then. First up, Paul.
In the science news this week, according to the government's Climate Change Committee, CCC, the UK should introduce a maximum temperature for workplaces to protect people as heat waves intensify. Very interesting, because we've got one coming this week.
We have indeed.
The CCC has not suggested a maximum temperature for UK workplaces, but has referred to the example of Spain, where the maximum legal working temperature indoors is 27 degrees Celsius for sedentary work and 25 degrees Celsius for light physical work. Last year was the UK's warmest year on record, with drought and low water levels also affecting much of the country. The CCC has advised that rolling out air conditioning and other cooling technologies in schools and hospitals should be one of the government's highest priorities due to increasingly extreme heat waves in the UK.
Indeed, I think Monday we're due for 31 degrees or something from being pretty cold. Meanwhile, elsewhere in the news, redevelopment plans for Cambridge Science Park could create 20,000 new jobs and facilities for the public. More than 7,000 people currently work at the site, which is actually the oldest science park in Europe. And the people working there develop technologies and medicines. It was founded in 1970 by Trinity College, Cambridge. The Cambridge Science Park has been responsible for breakthroughs including cancer drugs, Bluetooth technology and mobile phone chips. The site, which is already open to the public, would also feature outdoor exhibits, an open-air museum and strengthen links to the Cambridge Science Centre, which encourages participation in STEM subjects. That's STEM. STEM subjects are science, technology, engineering and mathematics, and they form the foundation for problem-solving, innovation and critical thinking in modern education and careers. All interesting stuff.
Elsewhere in the news, distinctive red-billed choughs have been spotted at Tintagel Castle for the first time in decades. It is a site for which they have special significance. The castle is said to be the birthplace of King Arthur, whose soul, according to legend, lived on the form of a chough after his death. And Britain's largest bird of prey, the white-tailed eagle, is also returning to Exmoor thanks to a pioneering conservation project. Permission has been granted for the return of birds to the National Park after the success of a project on the Isle of Wight, where 45 birds have been released since 2019.
So that's a bit of brief roundup of some of the science news this week. And next up is an article that I saw in the press a while back. It was titled Arrested Development. Very interesting one, this. And the subtitle was Solutions to Stop the Overuse of Tech Among Children Must Come from Many Sources. Parents of under fives will be keenly aware that when their access to a source of pleasure and diversion is thwarted, be that ice cream or the park swings, the resulting fury could often power the national grid. And when the confiscation of electronic devices is involved, the surge of outrage can be even more explosive. While being a responsible parent has always involved setting limits, it is still easy for bad habits to take root. The latest government advice that under five should have no more than 1 hour of screen time a day, and under 2 year olds should have scarcely any at all, might seem self-evidently sensible, yet even those restrictions will cause many adults to take a deep breath. Compared with a decade ago, the use of screens by very young children has risen steadily. In the UK, 98% of 2 year olds watch screens on a typical day and for an average duration of more than 2 hours. Ofcom research last year found that 19% of children aged between 3 and 5 now have their own mobile phone. That's aged between 3 and 5. A percentage that rises to nearly 1/3 once a child is between 6 and 7 years old. Unsurprisingly, the effects of excessive screen time, particularly on young children, are causing ever more concern. 90% of children's development happens by the age of 5, and there is evidence that over-immersion in technology happens at the expense of social and linguistic skills. Those who work with children entering primary school say they can spot those who spend much of their day on electronic devices. They are often less interested in toys or imaginary play, find it difficult to follow instructions, and are shy about face-to-face interactions. Wired to the fast-changing stimulation of the online world, they can find real-life tasks frustrating. The negative effects of such early delays, experts suggest, can dog children throughout their school life. The new government guidance, developed by a panel led by the Children's Commissioner Dame Rachel D'Souza and the paediatrician Professor Russell Viner, is a timely reminder that young children are social creatures. The best stimulus they can receive is through interaction with fellow human beings in the physical world. Yet it falls to adults too to moderate their own use of devices around children. It's a frequent but dispiriting sight to witness toddlers effectively begging for a parent or carer's attention while the adult's gaze remains locked on a small portable screen with no imminent prospect of removal. We live in a world of rapidly evolving technology, and it can be tempting to lay all its ills at one door. The recent US case in which a jury found the Facebook owner Meta and Google's YouTube liable for a 20-year-old woman's psychological distress could well herald an altered legal landscape for social media companies. But as society struggles with metabolizing what is in effect a highly addictive electronic drug, all must play their part. Schools should ban smartphones from classrooms, allowing all children a device-free stretch of the day. MPs and peers should continue work on restricting social media access for under 16s. And technology companies must be more ingenious in offering customers better calibrated A better calibrated range of smartphones, for example, which permits some useful features such as music and maps, but not others. If we wish to be the masters of technology rather than its slaves, the solution must come from many sources. I thought it was an absolutely cracking report, Arrested Development, and it's about stopping the use of tech amongst younger children, but of course it could apply to us all. Cracking track there from EMF with Children, because we're talking about Arrested Development. Remember that 90% of children's development happens by the age of 5, and there's growing evidence that over-immersion in technology happens at the expense of social and linguistic skills. Very, very interesting. You are, of course, listening to Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We should have our PG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
Happy
morning.
Sunny bank holiday.
Yeah, I feel like I should be singing today. It's so lovely.
But, it is indeed.
Don't.
It's very unusual for us to have a really lovely bank holiday when everybody's off and the schools are off as well.
Well, I knew it was a bank holiday because I've had a traffic jam outside since about 7 o'clock.
Oh, all going to the countryside, eh, Paul?
We are, and going through roadworks, because they always decide to put the roadworks on bank holiday.
So what's caught your eye in the science news this week then, Paul?
Well, I think we're talking about people's extremes of behaviour, but I thought I'd touch upon a few extremes that are passing around the world at the moment. So news from Japan that they've tested a Mach 5 engine, and that's a ramjet that... they've managed to sustain its output at the equivalent of reaching Mach 5. So Mach 1 is 767 miles an hour, so that takes you up to about 3,500 miles an hour. It's a joint project between JAXA and Waseda University in Japan, and they're aiming for achieving passenger flights using this technology in the 2040s. And you sort of wonder why we should look at Mach 5 travel in today's day and age, but technology moves on. And also, there's an alternative technology to ramjets, which is the scramjet. And in America, they've tested that in a vehicle called the Boeing X-51 Wave Rider. That's an unmanned craft at the moment, but that uses a scramjet. And the difference between the two is that ramjet takes in air and drops it down to subsonic speeds to fire the engine, whereas a scramjet takes in the supersonic air that it's travelling through and uses that to fire the engine. So the difference is that in a ramjet, they say that theoretically Mach 5 is about the top output for it, whereas a scramjet, Mach 5, could exceed that and go up to maybe Mach 10, is the estimates for that technology. So what kind of challenges are they going to run into? Well, I think some of the problems is that travelling through the atmosphere, they get atmospheric friction, and that can cause extreme heating. So historically, what comparison have we got? And a lot of people these days will have seen the American spy plane, or reconnaissance plane as it's called, and that's a Lockheed product. It's the SR-71 Blackbird, which currently is travelling at somewhat over Mach 3. And to achieve that, they had to construct its body out of titanium because of the sort of movement due to heat. And it's put together loosely. And the reason for that is when it's on the ground, they fill it up with fuel and they allow the fuel to leak until it reaches its operational altitude, by which time the heat has swollen up the body of the aircraft until it becomes sort of tight and can contain its fuel. So amazing technology that you've got to sort of deal with. And I think it was a long-range, high-altitude reconnaissance plane, which in its day could outrun anything that an opponent fired at it by flying faster. So that's changing now, because we're seeing, because of warfare around the world, hypersonic weapons are being developed, and some of those become hypersonic through re-entry from space. So there are rockets fired into space, and as it falls, it picks up speed and becomes hypersonic. Or they're looking at these engine capacities to be able to power a craft. So pretty extreme, I thought that. And I thought then, well, you know, what's nature got to offer in terms of extremes? And in August last year, there was a massive mega tsunami in Alaska. And it created a 500-meter high wave. You know, just imagine that. That's bigger than a lot of the tallest buildings in the world. And sort of some of those sci-fi movies, it kind of shows you what really happens in the real world. So this event occurred in Alaska in the Tracy Arm Fjord. And all at once, 64 million cubic meters of rock. And that's kind of roughly the equivalent to 24 Great Pyramids, fell at one go into the fjord and created this massive wave. So previous tsunamis, there was a tsunami in Alaska again in Lituya Bay, and that actually beat the Tracy Arm with a 524-meter tsunami created. Tracy Arm comes second at just below 500 metres. And then going back in history, in 2024, The Dixon Fjord in Greenland created a 200-metre-high tsunami. And then Hunga Tonga, which is an eruption in 2022, created a 90-metre tsunami. And Tohoku in Japan in 2011 created a 40.5-metre tsunami. So they're saying that this sort of increasing to possibly 10 times as frequently as happened in the past. So mega tsunamis is also crediting climate change because of the melting glaciers and the changes that are happening around the world. So big scale things are happening, I guess. And say, talking about the melting glaciers, then something that sort of takes me back to early childhood, and that's looking at Mount Everest. Mount Everest is still, I think, classified the tallest mountain on the planet. It's 8,848.86 metres, or 29,031.7 feet, as of December 2020, which was supposedly the most recent accurate assessment of its height. But something happened in last year. There was a finding in some of the glacial flow that was coming down Everest, and the expedition at that time came across a climbing boot sticking up out of the glacier. When they managed to remove it from the ice, they found it was a boot with a sock inside, and inside the sock was a stitched-in label, and it was for A. Irving. And so, I say, going back to my childhood, 1953, we had the famous Everest expedition with Hillary and Tenzing, and that was classified as the first time people had reached the summit. But Andrew Sandy Irving and George Mallory were British climbers who went to Everest in 1924. And they were climbing up the mountain, and then they were lost and undiscovered. So 2024 was the finding of the boot and the sock. But in 1994, an expedition had found the remains of Mallory, and it proved that he'd had a drastic fall due to the injuries on his pretty well preserved body, they said. So climbing Everest is a dangerous thing, and I just thought one of the things that quite often comes on is, can you boil an egg when you get to the top of Everest? So, what's your vote? Do you think you'd be okay whipping out your saucepan and boiling an egg on the peak of Everest?
The altitude will be high, won't it?
Not a lot of oxygen as well.
Well, I'm going to... The obvious answer is to say no, Paul, but I'm going to say yes.
Yeah, well, there is, but there's a caveat that if you try and do it the traditional way, the altitude makes a 30-degree difference. So when you're normally boiling your egg, it's 100 degrees and the water's boiling. But when you get to the altitude of the peak of Everest, it drops by 30 degrees. And an egg cooks in two parts. The yolk cooks at a temperature, but the white doesn't cook until it's beyond 85 degrees.
Well,
get you.
Yeah, you couldn't actually go and do it traditionally, but there's a crafty move which happened in a lot of households, I think, as I was growing up, and that was the occurrence of the pressure cooker. And if you happen to take a pressure cooker and use that to boil your egg, it can, because the pressure difference changes the apparent altitude, it means that you get a higher temperature, so you can boil your egg if you use a pressure cooker.
But if you've got a pressure cooker at the top of Everest, Paul?
Yes, it's one of those things. But I think, Yeah, for me, it's one of those sort of extremes, I think, around the world that we cope with. And I think if you're going to go back to the beginning of what I was saying, we're pursuing Mach 5 plus travel to cut travel times across the Pacific, is the intention of the Japanese work, to sort of halve the time to travel across the Pacific, which is a long trip. But do we actually need it? You know, at the moment we're struggling to get ordinary flights to go, mm-hmm. and if you talk to environmentalists, they're really questioning why we would go beyond the flights that we have now. Instead, they'd like to see it reverse because of the problems with the atmosphere. And I think I mentioned last week that a surprise discovery recently is that there's soot in the upper reaches of the atmosphere from that many rocket launches that have happened. So sending up these fleets of satellites for fast sort of internet connections and lots of other things, GPS and other things which currently we're starting to rely on Earth increasingly. But the question is it the right way forward? Or should we look at things like electric aircraft, which reduce the power demand, apparently, until you start to get into the actual way that you build and create those things? So, realistically, I think instant gratification is becoming one of the things, and I think from your example of the child with not having access, people's... I mean, there was a thing, I think, when I used to be working in video, was that everybody wanted their 15 minutes of fame, and they had an attention span of probably 5 minutes, which was what the thought was many years ago. But it's more like 15 seconds now.
If that, Paul.
Yeah, so it really is, you know, the doom scrolling that you get with your telephones and other things. People have become enslaved to that technology, and I think increasingly now we're starting to ask, to what benefit?
Yeah, on Soul Plus, Paul, if you tuned in, we play a track from Sheffield's very own Heaven 17, and it's a track called We Live So Fast.
Yep.
And absolutely. That was written back in, that was an 82 version, but it came off an 83 album. But they were talking about that then, and you think, my word, the world's even faster.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I say, so much of technology, like you say, back to the jets. You know, I think Concorde reached Mach 2, potentially. I think the SR-71 ended up reaching Mach 3.2, but we're looking at these vehicles now to do Mach 5 beyond, and it's sort of again, one of the things is, if you were flying at the height that they intend to fly and didn't have a pressurized cabin, you wouldn't survive.
No.
So one of the things when you see air disasters, if some engine fault happens at the cruising sort of height, the immediate reaction from the crew is to drop the aeroplane down to an atmosphere level where we can actually breathe at that atmospheric level, because we can't if pressurization of the cabin fails at the height. And to achieve that while people are still alive and able to respond means you're going to drop altitude massively quickly.
That's enough to put you off flying, Paul. Even if you could get on a plane and there was enough fuel.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of things. You know, we've sort of developed flight. Certainly, aviation developed after the Second World War. And greatly after the First World War, they created large planes to deliver bombs. And after the war, because they were redundant, they started to modify them to carry passengers. And that carried on, and after the Second World War, the technology had moved on, and passenger flight moved on, and hey, we got the jet engine. So we got the aeroplanes that were running with jet engines, and we're seeing today one of the problems that the world's demand for jet engine fuel is such that because of the upheaval in the Middle East, everybody's worried about whether they can make their flights, whether their flights will go, and we've become so used to it.
Yes.
Again, I think you're going to have a bit of a nasty sort of turn about not getting your three holidays a year in, or whatever your norm is these days. But I think that's the span. You know, continually we try and push boundaries. And one that I saw today, which I'll sign off on, I think, is the move to use the same technology that created the COVID-19 immunisation product. It's been chased by the same team in Oxford in using the vehicle that they use for that to create immunisation for the Ebola outbreak.
Yeah, yes. An interesting one, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And they're saying that in normal times it would be a 5 to 10 year programme, but they're seriously looking at doing that in sort of months.
Yeah,
yes. Equivalent.
So something game-changing that did come out of COVID.
Yeah, absolutely.
That speed of collaboration and getting through the trials and everything. And the same AI helps as well, as I think.
Yep, it certainly is. They're applying that. And also that understanding our past. They've used it to look at cuneiform tablets. And there are, I think, 30,000 plus tablets and fragments of tablets from ancient times that are in different collections and museums, and they can use artificial intelligence to interpret them and understand the society and what was happening a long time ago.
Paul?
Yes?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Going back to Mount Everest, what recipes do you recommend for cooking up there?
Well, I think if you use the north face, you might not face.
I thought we got Delia Smith on then.
with
the egg.
August, but you've chosen a fantastic track, Paul. It is a belter of a track. Because you were talking about Everest and sort of going up hills and things.
I thought you'd be a runner this one, so it's Kate Bush and running up that hill.
Marvellous, Paul.
A deal with God.
A deal with God, indeed. We'll speak to you Monday, Glory Days Rock Show, 1 till 3, Paul. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Cheers. Bye, guys. Bye. Yeah.
Cracking over track there by Kate Bush, of course, running up that hill because our PG was talking about Everest and all sorts of other things. We all, of course, listen to Live Sounds Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We should have Chris Dale on the line. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, team. How are we?
We're very well. Thank you for joining us on this sunny bank holiday weekend.
Yeah, it's beautiful weather.
Yeah. It is. Enjoy it. We brought you in there with a bit of a bug facer from Hull. Fiery demon. Fiery demon attacks old man on bridge. What a tune.
It's a classic.
So, Chris, this week you're going to talk about something very interesting that's been in the press.
Yeah, so as you mentioned last week, Julie, it was revealed that a chicken sandwich is packing as much salt as 5 McDonald's cheeseburgers, putting it at the top of the naughty list of more than 500 sandwiches that were analysed. The Sarnie, which was sold by a bakery chain, Gales, contains 6.88 grams of salt, and that's more than the UK's recommended daily limit of 6 grams of salt, or the World Health Organization's 5-gram cap. So clearly not the healthiest choice. So I thought today I would talk about salt and its impact on the human body. So first of all, salt is essential to the human body. It's used in cooking, it's a powerful cleaning agent, and it's a natural remedy for sore throats and skin irritation, and it's also a highly effective preservative. However, too much can be dangerous, and salt is also a real danger to babies as they cannot absorb salt in their diet. As I said earlier, the UK government recommends around 6 grams of salt a day, which is about 1 level teaspoon. However, the average person in the UK consumes about 8.4 grams daily, which is about 1.5 teaspoons of salt a day. And that's because 75% of our salt intake is already hidden in everyday processed food.
Same old thing, eh, Chris?
It's the same old thing. There's some statistics later that I'm going to share with you, Julie and Paul, which really shocked me. And despite all the work we've been doing about healthy food, it still never fails that I find some statistic that shocks us. But anyway, the director of the World Health Organization says excessive salt consumption remains upon the top preventable diseases globally and puts the figure at around 1.7 million deaths a year. And that shocked me as well, that amount of people were suffering from too much salt. So as the body absorbs salt from a meal, what's it doing to us and why are we all eating so much? So as I said earlier, the human body needs sodium to function, and you can find the element in almost every cell of the body. It's needed for our nerves to communicate with each other and for our body to maintain the right balance of water. But the amount we need is actually very, very small in the grand scheme of things. And in comparison to the amount of salt we're actually eating, we should be eating far less. So too much salt has many effects on the body, but the clearest evidence is how it impacts on blood pressure. The salt we eat ends up in the bloodstream, where it draws extra water and increases the volume of our blood. And this gives the heart a bigger job of pumping it around the body and copes by dialing up blood pressure, a bit like cranking up the tap on a garden hose pipe.
Yeah. It's bad news, Chris, isn't it?
Yeah, and the thing about blood pressure, it's known as the silent killer. So you may not know that you have high blood pressure until something goes wrong and that extra pressure ruptures a blood vessel like a burst pipe, causing a stroke or heart attack. So salt also alters blood vessels themselves to make them stiffer and increase the risk to health. In addition to that, I understand that salt can almost damage our kidneys, which filters our blood. It leaches calcium out of our bones, making them more frail. Salt has also been linked to vascular dementia, stomach cancer, and emerging evidence suggests that it alters our immune system. And again, I knew about blood pressure, but I didn't know about those other things as well. So having a one-off salt meal isn't going to impact on your long-term health, says Sonia Pumbo, who's a researcher at Queen's University in London. Because what salt does, it very gradually and silently raises your blood pressure over the course of your lifetime. So even though she personally tries to eat a healthy diet most of the time, because she researches on this, the data on how much salt we are eating is not reassuring. So even her, who manages her diet, is still eating around 6 grams a day. The UK Nutrition Survey monitored urine in 24 hours for people to see how much salt they've been eating. And their results suggest that men are averaging around 9.2 grams a day and women about 7.6 grams a day. And the difference between men and women is that men generally eat more food. And then with salt, you can't sweat it out unless you're a super highly trained athlete. And you can't flush it out by drinking lots of water. So a diet packed with fruit and vegetables rather than ultra-processed food, which contain potassium, can counterbalance some of the salt. But it doesn't make it okay, because one thing doesn't cancel another thing. So basically, you can't, if you eat a lot of salt, you can't counterbalance it. You just need to cut salt out of your diet. So what I was going to do was just talk to you a little bit about the salt that we're eating every day. Where is it coming from? And this is where I said that it gave me a real shock. Okay.
Yeah.
So the number one form of salt that we take, which is 12% of our salt, comes from sandwiches. And that's because there's salt already contained in the bread. Then we add things like cheese and ham, which already have salt in them. And then on top of that, we add things like chutneys and mayonnaise and things like that, which also have salt in them. So sandwiches are an ultra-processed food, I guess, particularly if you buy them in the supermarket, and that accounts for 12% of your salt intake. The next one is savory sauces, like cooking ingredients, spices, so tomato ketchup, HP sauce. Then bread, 4% comes from things like poultry, chicken, that sort of thing, 4% from pizza, 3% from cheese, 3% from processed meat like bacon and sausages, that sort of thing. Savory snacks, and which I thought would have been the highest, 3%. And then soup bought from supermarkets also contains about 3%. And then burgers, kebabs, that sort of thing also is around 3% of your ultra-processed food. But yeah, 12% comes from sandwiches. Never knew that.
Yeah, and the article was saying, it's people often buy sandwiches, don't you? You're on your lunch break, you buy a sandwich, you think it's, you don't necessarily look at the label, you just think it's going to be good.
Yeah, and you have the meal deal, which is a sandwich, a packet of crisps, and then a fizzy drink.
Ooh.
And between them, you're mixing there your classic salt, sugar, fat.
Yes.
Which is, as we know, it's the key ingredient of ultra-processed food. But the other thing I was just going to say is that in the UK, we have actually reduced our salt within ultra-processed foods by around sort of 10 to 12%. So actually, we brought some soup back from the Netherlands, and we hadn't, you know, we it sat in our cupboard for 6 months, and then we ate it, and we couldn't eat it because it was so salty.
You've said this before,
over in Europe, they don't have the same restrictions on salt that we have in the UK. So, salt is most likely already in the food we eat, rather than something we sprinkle on top. Although, obviously, if you're having your fish and chips, you can't have those without a sprinkle of salt. It's pretty much in everything. And it's not always in foods that taste super salty. So bread, in all its form, features so prominently in the list above because we eat so much of it. We can all make healthier choices, of course, and seek out food with less salt in them if we're prepared to read the label, Julie, which you've already spoken about.
Yeah, but you know, you look on some, if you look on the back of a label and it's got 50 ingredients, which is bad, that's a big red flag anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, and like you say, salt being so prevalent in our food means campaigners think the responsibility for cutting it out has to lie with the people that make the food, which is the food producers, which is exactly what you're saying, because they're choosing to put the salt and the ingredients in because they think that's what we want, and that's what we want to buy.
And salt's a preservative, isn't it?
Absolutely. So... So, according to Professor Francesco Cappuccio from the University of Warwick, salt can be taken out by manufacturers, but they don't want to do so because it's very cheap.
Ah.
And when you go to a pub and you get your salted peanuts on the counter, it's not by chance, he says, you buy an extra pint of lager because salt makes you thirsty. And also, salt is a really cheap way of improving the flavour of food or masking the flavor of bad food. So by adding salt, you can make terrible food taste nice just by putting salt in it. So we always get a spokesperson from who represents the food market. So a spokesman for the Food and Drink Federation said its members' products have nearly a third less salt in it than 2015, and the industry has made significant investment in innovation to develop healthier products. But that was because of government intervention, not because they were doing it voluntarily.
Yes.
Because the government brought in this rule to try and reduce the amount of salt. The other thing is hospitality venues invest significantly in nutrition and healthy eating to give customers the best possible choice when eating out. And the range and choice of food that is offered in the hospitality industry enables customers to choose to eat away from home, and building healthy choices has been a real priority. However, the big thing is that restaurants only sell food if the food is tasty. So, for instance, if somebody is eating a healthy salad, they then often add salad dressing, and the salad dressing is full of salt. And of course, we often add sauces like ketchup, HP sauce, to say a full English breakfast, which is already very unhealthy.
Yeah.
So, Julie, what am I going to say? So, as a rule, avoid processed food, avoid ready meals, avoid finger snacks like crisps, salami, and sandwiches. And last but not least, I'm going to give the Life Science Radio Show verdict around salt. Make sure you look at the list of ingredients on the food that you buy, and preferably always cook your own food so you know what you're eating.
Great advice. Or make your own sandwiches.
You do that yourself.
Yeah, but you, when we started looking at breads, and this, I'll mention Marks and Spencer's. When I looked, this was about a year or so ago, looked at every label on their bread, and every sort of bread had a really high amount of salt per slice or per, you know. And there was only one loaf of bread that had the least ingredients in it and hardly any salt compared to everything else. But now they're starting to introduce much clearer labelling. The label is on the front of the packaging, and particularly they're introducing ranges that have only got 5-6 ingredients in, and they list them right on the front, telling you exactly how much salt, sugar, fat is in those products. And I think that's where it's all going to have to go. But they're doing it voluntarily. They're not being told to do that.
Yeah, and a lot of people are going to Marks and Spencer's because it's helping them make good choices.
And once you get used to eating less processed food, because they're using, instead of salts and things they, like E numbers they would have used in a lot of products, they're using natural preservatives like lemon juice, things to to get around it. Yeah, yeah. And the next one, and the big one's nitrates in your bacon.
That's in bacon.
And ham and stuff like that.
Sausages.
And sausages, which don't say it's the same, because, Mark, to be fair to him, Chris, Marks and Spencer's does some sausages with hardly any ingredients in them. No nitrates, nothing. But it just tastes like pork.
Right.
But there, you know, it's what your palate is used to, and that's all about ultra-processed food, isn't it?
But, you know, we don't... I think it's more a case of also thinking about it, isn't it, and understanding what you are eating. And you can make bread at home with only five ingredients, with much reduced salt. You can buy bread from supermarkets that only use five ingredients, but unfortunately you have to eat them on the day.
This is
they
it.
Don't preserve.
And it's same food. For a lot of food, particularly desserts, for example. The most of the ones that have got very limited ingredients or very pure ingredients, they've got shelf life of maybe 2 days.
Yeah.
So you can see why. Yeah. And, you know, cost of living as well, Chris. You know, some people can't afford to buy, you know, better stuff. And some, dare I say, some cheaper supermarkets, maybe the list of ingredients is even higher on some of the products.
Well, I'm just going to remind you of one statistic that I've used on the radio show many times, but it's worth mentioning it again. If you were to make a lemon drizzle cake and you bought all the ingredients from the supermarket and you cooked it at home, it would cost you around £4.30 to £4.50. If you were to buy one at a supermarket, it costs the manufacturer 22 pence to make a lemon drizzle cake.
Because there's no lemon in it, Chris, is there?
Because there's no lemon in it. It's just chemicals that make it taste like lemon. So I think that's a really good statistic. So to all our listeners, it's time to reduce your salt intake.
It is indeed. And as you said in your chat, Chris, about one of the important things is what salt does to your blood pressure. And so we've chosen, or you've chosen, a fantastic track. Do you want to say what it is?
Oh, it's the Stereo MCs.
With
and the song's Pressure.
Excellent. Have a great bank holiday weekend, Chris.
Thank you, Chris.
All right. And
bye-bye.
By the way, just to say, Glory Days Rock Show is absolutely fantastic.
It rocks.
So your listeners should listen
to
that.
Yeah, well, we're in. You'll be listening on Monday, I hope. Glory Days Rock Show 1, 2, 3.
Nice one.
Bye-bye, Chris. Bye-bye.
Bye. Take care.
To say, then keep your mouth shut out the way, you'll get no flattery. If you know the time of day, then why'd you let yourself go grey? You need a battery. Cause every moment counts as the watchdog waste of pounds, but he ain't smart as me. With a Bible on his lips and a pistol on his hip, ain't blinding me. So just remember, don't believe all you see. Things ain't always how they're meant to be. Some come as villain, dressed as virtue, but all they really wanna do is hurt you, and that's reality. Gotta keep it up. We gotta keep it up, keep it up, keep up the pressure. We gotta
save our souls. Saints preserve us. Hold on tight now and don't get nervous. Bring it on quick before the light fade. Dear little lover coming out the shade. At first you act like you don't know me, and all you seem to care about is money. And every day it seems to get harder. I don't know how we're gonna reach a father. Gotta keep it up, keep it up, keep up the pressure. We gotta keep it up, keep it up, keep up the pressure.
Track there from the Stereo MC's Pressure, because Christelle was talking about salt in our diets. Read your labels if you're still buying ultra-processed food. Of course, listen to Live Sounds Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We're here every Saturday morning, 11 till 12, talking about science in all its different forms. We're nearly at the end of the show, but just a bit of time to talk about a few vegetables as we're talking about what you eat. Garlic. Pound for pound, garlic is one of the healthiest vegetables you can eat. So potent that you don't have to make the French classic chicken with 40 cloves of garlic to benefit, although you should because it's delicious, so says the article. But you will have to try harder than ordering garlic bread as a starter. Little and often is best. Most evidence suggests that garlic's benefits come from regular consumption as part of a balanced diet rather than large amounts less frequently. Garlic is a source of vitamin C, prebiotic fiber and manganese for bone health and balancing blood sugar. One of its greatest benefits is allicin, released when you crush, grate or chop the cloves, which is associated with lowered blood pressure and cholesterol. Another one, mushrooms. Now, I know our Chris is allergic, but it's still a good vegetable if you can't eat it. The most underrated item on the vegetable list, this article says, with a different nutrient profile from most other vegetables, they're a valuable addition to many diets. Mushrooms grown in sunlight or UV light contain vitamin D, which is vital for bone, teeth and muscle health. Most supermarkets now sell varieties of wild and vitamin D mushrooms. It will be marked on the packet. All mushrooms are rich in B vitamins and selenium to support your immune system and are one of the few foods containing eicothionein, an antioxidant that supports cognitive function and heart health. I personally put mushrooms in just about every spaghetti bolognese, chili, even curry. So if you're not allergic to them, get them in your diet. So thanks for listening. We're going to play out with a bit of In Excess. Taste it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.